So I wanted to reflect a bit with us tonight about this core quality in the Dharma of nonviolence. The Pali term is avihingsa. The Sanskrit is ahimsa. So it literally means not harming. We chant it in the as the first precept, panatipata, veratmani, sikapatang, samadhiyami. I take the training precept of not taking life or not taking the life of any living creature. And it's at the heart of ethical practice. And in a certain way, it's so foundational that I think it can slip under the radar and maybe we don't think about it so much. So I want to reflect on some threads around this this quality of nonviolence. This is partly inspired by my day job, where I'm the editor, among other things, at Spirit Rock. And the guiding teachers just put out, some might say at long last, a statement reflecting a bit on the war in Israel and Gaza, and really centering the quality of nonviolence as the core, one of the core Buddhist teachings that speaks to how we might relate to a war that is devastating, heartbreaking, horrific, and particularly how we might relate to the urge to take sides or decide who is right or wrong in any given conflict, whether that one or another one. And so I'm not going to dissect their statement or agree with it or disagree with it. I'm gonna do what the Buddha would sometimes do, and not pick up an argument that one might have with anyone. But I think that the emphasis in their statement, bringing forward the teaching on nonviolence, was really had a beautiful intent in it. And if we pull out that intention, can really be quite radical, right? So non-harming or non-violence is, it's the beginning of, it's often taught at the beginning of the path. It's the foundation of the precepts. And the precepts are relational, right? So we have these guidelines for how to act in order to give rise to the kind of communities we want to live in. So not to kill or steal or commit sexual misconduct or misuse speech through lying or harsh speech, deception, and to not misuse intoxicants such that we fall into states where, we're more likely to make errors relationally and cause harm. And so the precepts are, they are trainings that individuals take on, monastics or lay people. The monastics have a much more detailed spread of precepts to take on. These are the five lay precepts, these five basic ones. And so they are an internal training, but they're relational. And so they really are, they are practiced in our interactions with each other, how we speak to each other, how we touch each other, how we share space, how we relate to each other as human beings. And in this way, they it initiates this bridge between inner and outer that continues throughout the whole path. One way of thinking about the path, the Noble Eightfold Path, or sometimes called the Path of Purification, is of an ever-increasing refinement of the practice of nonviolence. So if we start off with a kind of simple not always easy, but maybe straightforward external nonviolence. Like I'm going to try not to kill beings, you know, and maybe for a while I get really, you know, concerned about how I'm cleaning up the ants who invade my kitchen or how I deal with mosquitoes and things like that. And those are worthwhile reflections. Like I don't dismiss the work done trying to figure out how to be a nonviolent being, you know, in a moist forest at dusk in the summertime, when you are also dinner for all sorts of midges and gnats and mosquitoes and, you know, and what to do when 1,000 ants come into the kitchen looking for crumbs and, you know. So that's great, like work with that. And of course, the challenge for lay people that monastics don't have as a challenge, by the way, the challenge of what to eat is a real thing. So I don't want to shy away from saying that I think being vegetarian is awesome. I love it myself. And in a funny way, it's one of the most contentious issues in Dharma land. People really don't like being told what to eat. So that's okay. No problem. I'm not telling you. But I think it's wonderful for folks who want to practice nonviolence to really think in a clear and, you know, ideally not defensive way about what we eat and broadly how we spend our money, you know, what are the impacts upon life generally in the choices that we make. And so that's what we eat, what we wear, where we go, how we travel, right? You can tell very quickly that orienting toward non-harming and then being, you know, a human being almost anywhere on the planet right now in the given condition of the, you know, consumer marketplace is to understand that we are causing harm, you know, in deep but often invisible ways, because the harm is generally offshored. You know, where do your clothes come from? Where did your car come from? Where does your fuel come from? Everything touches beings, you know, nearby in your neighborhood or on the other side of the planet or both, in webs of connection that are very difficult to see. And the number of beings affected, often in very painful ways, by the global commercial system is intense. And it's totally appropriate to reflect on that, to feel the impact of our actions. And I think one of the things that's a profound practice right now that may not have been as much of a practice in the time of the Buddha, when all food was local and all clothing was local and everything was local, essentially, you know, with very few exceptions, you know, a few pieces of jade and lapis traveling around the Asian continent from east to west, but most commodities were local. Now we live in a place where it's very unlikely that we know the people who made our clothes or grew our food or, you know, wrote our books. And so just to know that, and that it's a practice to be with this. So non-harming in the external spreads out globally. And I think reflecting on those aspects of it, in terms of the Eightfold Path, the place that I normally put it is in the right livelihood limb, which we talk about probably the least of all the eight limbs. The ethical limbs are our speech, action, livelihood. And I think of them as opening outward from the first wisdom limb of right view. Right view is like deep, inherited, mostly worldview. And it opens into intention, right? So the mostly unconscious ideas we have about who we are and what the world is like, those things give rise to the intentions we hold for how we are in the world. And then those intentions take form into action. And the first action, this maybe goes back to that conversation we were having about mantra, the first action is speech, right? Before there's before there's physical action, or subtler than physical action, closer to the body in a way, is speaking. So speaking is like the first action, and it brings ideas into form, it brings beings into form. In a mystical way, nothing exists until it's named. Like maybe it exists, but if you don't know it's there and you don't know its name, it doesn't really exist to you, so it doesn't exist. And so things come into being when they are named. This is a concept that crosses religions in a very deep way, right? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Or in the beginning, God breathed upon the waters, right? Or, you know, the image from the Kabbalah of the Jewish people, that in the very beginning there was void, and then a single flaming letter, the Aleph, appears in the void, which is why the Hebrew letters are shaped like little flames, classically. The letter A appears in the void, so speech is the first action to spring forward from intention. You know this because when you make an intention, of course you say it, right? You say it to yourself, or you say it to someone else, or you say it around a fire on New Year's, or however you do it. You say it in a ritual with your Buddhist friends. But you speak something, and when you speak it, especially if you speak it out loud, and especially if that speech is witnessed, it has power, right? It has what the modern theorists would call performativity. It creates something by being spoken. Performativity is a concept that began with an investigation by a philosopher named Austin, who was thinking about language and about how language changes the world. But some kinds of language, initially he thought some kinds of language change the world very directly, and some kinds, you know, don't really. And so some kind of language is performative and some isn't. And the, you know, the quintessential example of performative language is the saying of "I do" in a marriage ceremony. You get to that point in the ceremony and you say, you know, and the officiant says, "Do you?" And you say, "I do." And says to the other person, "Do you?" They say, "I do." And the priest says, "It's done," right? What changed before those words and after is everything. Because now you're married. And that's real, right? And everyone takes it to be real. It was just words. Words were spoken in the right ritual moment with intention, and you meant it. You can do a wedding ceremony, by the way, on stage in the theater, and you could do it 180 times if you have a nice long run on Broadway. You say, "I do," every night, and nothing happens. You're not married to the other actor, right? You go home to your respective spouses, if you have them, or whatever. No one thinks that you got married, because the magic spell doesn't have the right context. And so performative language is language in the right context. It's usually a ritual context, you know. And so speaking is action, right? And so the beginning then of applying nonviolence is nonviolence in our words. And the Buddha is very clear about nonviolence manifesting in words, right? Not speaking in ways that are harsh or untrue or untimely or not helpful. Speaking in a way that's beautiful, delicious to hear, pleasurable. And often folks get stuck right here. And particularly folks with an orientation toward activism can get stuck here because we can certainly come up with situations where it seems like harsh speech, or at least very forceful, sharp speech is appropriate in meeting an intense situation or an intense body of harm. And also, you can see folks who are oppressed in various ways or suffering and not want to tone police them, essentially. Not want to say like, "Oh, you know, we shouldn't use harsh speech. And so, you know, I think it's a good reminder with the ethical precepts and with nonviolence that this is a practice that we do for ourselves, and to be very careful before we project it onto others. We don't actually know what their intention is much of the time, even if we think we are siblings in Sangha. People may be coming from very different places. And it's kind of just annoying to tell other people how to talk, you know? So don't do that, unless you absolutely must. But for ourselves, I think it's beautiful to practice with our words in a way where we are inviting the deep ethos of not causing harm, the deep ethos of nonviolence into our words, and then from there into our actions with each other, really respecting and delighting in the precepts as protection in this world, in a very complex world. So externally, in our actions in the world, nonviolence begins as a way to work with our words and our actions and our livelihood, which is to say our economic actions, in the way that all of those actions touch others, and they can either cause you know, help and healing or harm and distress. And of course, often intention is mixed and actions are mixed and conditions are complicated, and you know, there's no guarantee, right? You do your best, and beings get hurt, beings get helped, and we just keep trying to refine external actions. And so in the external world, then, as the intention for nonviolence becomes bigger, as it starts to spread out from my individual actions, it gets into really complicated territory, like, who do I vote for? You know, that's a personal action that somehow, and I still kind of think this is supposed to work, you know, more or less functionally, at least around here, that you vote for people who then vote for people who then get to make really big decisions about the world, you know? And, you know, to use the war in Gaza as an example, right? I voted for the guy that is running this country right now, and I approve of some of the things he's doing in relation to that war, and I disapprove of others. You know, I don't prefer it to be this way. But my practice has to be, or I want my practice to be, holding to the discipline and the intention of nonviolence, of non-harming, and then acting or working within a very complicated world the best I can. You know, there was no one to vote for who exactly matched my values, so you know, I got as close as I could, and now, you know, we continue to act to try to be as much in our integrity as we can with the larger world, even as it's, you know, even as it's profoundly complex and unsatisfying. So in the same way, then, as in the external world, you can bring this intention of nonviolence into larger and larger circles, and that's going to mean that you bump up against complexity and mixed intention and ancient karma and unfixable problems and other people, most centrally other people, all the time. You have to deal with that. In the same way, internally, then, I think the process has a similar trajectory. So internally, I begin with an intention toward nonviolence, toward non-harming, and maybe I start this off with, you know, how I relate to myself, right? I make the intention to speak kindly to myself. I make the intention to cultivate states that are well and healthy in myself. And so we can understand, for instance, you know, if we take like the instructions in concentration to, you know, set up the body in an easeful way, connect with the breathing or with the object of meditation, relax the body very deeply, let the breath or the attention spread to fill the body, and then relax even more deeply. Set aside kind of neurotic thought and obsessive thought, and let both the body and the mind relax. Right? These are the instructions that walk us toward jhana or meditative absorption. And we can feel these as a kind of internal expression of nonviolence. Oh, what's it like to be so gentle and kind and careful with how I treat myself that I that I work to like to drain away, you know, somatic tension or bound energies in the body, that I work to drain away the constriction, the painful constriction of obsessive thought patterns, of obsessive emotional patterns, of old emotional karma. I have to work on them to drain them away so they don't just go away. You have to sometimes attend to them, do your work. But what if all of this inner work is a form of bringing into more and more fullness the intention toward non-harming? How can I harm myself through my inner words and actions less and less and less and less and less and less, right? Until there's a deep fount of self-care and ease right here. And we were talking just before the talk a little bit about, you know, the Buddha remembering his childhood under the rose apple tree. And, you know, he had been doing this painful ascetic practice, starving himself to death. And you can understand his intuition. Could there be a better way? Also, as the arising of an impulse of non-harming in himself. Actually harming this body, harming myself, this can't be the way, he says. It just can't be it. It doesn't make any sense that this could work. And so he says, is there another way? And the thing he remembers is an image of what, you know, is almost like archetypally one of the deepest pleasures that we could imagine, right? He imagines a time in childhood before any of the adult worries or cares have come about. He imagines being outside in the springtime in a beautiful place under a beautiful tree, in a peaceful place, without anything nagging on his attention. This is essentially perfect conditions for well-being. If we were to imagine anything, you'd probably put yourself in that kind of place, you know, with that kind of mindset. The mind, you know, it's not even like, oh, if I were right now well-fed and in a spring park under a rose apple tree. It was like, no, when I was a child, it was like this. So all of the accumulated, you know, negative self-talk and potential harm that he may have come upon in those years of trying to punish the body, setting all that aside, you know, what a deep expression of taking care of this one, of not harming this one even a tiny bit. And he says, oh, that's the path. That's the path. And so as we deepen on the path, the various insights that come as concentration deepens and mindfulness deepens and insight begins to arise, all of these, in a way, can be felt like the ever-increasing circles of nonviolent intention spreading out into the world externally. These can be felt as ripples of the intention toward inner nonviolence and non-harming spreading internally. So, you know, the insight into anicca or impermanence that marks the opening of the Dharma eye, the insight into impermanence, you know, the neurotic thought that grasps at the future and that grasps at the present and that, you know, can't let a beautiful present moment slip away because we're so afraid that it will be lost, and and just fantasizes about the future and preserving what I have. Think of this as a kind of violence to the self, a violence to the one who's just here and now in this moment. So the idea of seeds comes from, it originated in a kind of a philosophical or theological problem, which was that it was observable, and the Buddha taught this, that some actions bear fruit right away. Like you see the result, you know, you speak harshly to someone and you see the result in their face immediately, right? Some actions bear fruit later on. You know, you break a precept and no one finds out about it for several years, and you go on to get rich or whatever, you know. Like, you don't seem to bear the fruit of that at all. But then sometime later in this lifetime, suddenly, you know, aha, you know, it comes back around, and you receive the fruit of that unwholesome action. But sometimes you die without having seemed to receive the apparent fruit of your actions. And so, and the Buddha was like, well, yeah, it could ripen in a later lifetime. And so that's true for both wholesome and unwholesome actions, right? You can do something good, but you can just like have terrible bad luck for the rest of your life, you know, get sick or murdered and die or whatever. And then people were like, oh, he was so good. Why didn't he bear the fruits of that goodness? And the Buddha might say, you know, other karma was ripening and those fruits will come later. And to solve that problem, because if everything is impermanent, the idea arose that no moment persisted past this immediate finger snap moment. And so if the next moment is radically disconnected from the previous moment, how could karma started by an action in one moment ripen later? There has to be something that connects them, right? This is a great philosophical problem. And so the solution to that was the idea that actions plant karmic seeds deep in the psyche, and it takes those seeds time to ripen. And so then the gradual and sudden thing is connected to this, because there could be the sense that as I engage in the process of purification, I'm practicing, I'm dealing with the mind stream, I'm cultivating wholesome states, I'm bringing this intention toward nonviolence more and more deeply into my psyche, and it takes a while to kind of layer by layer, you know, peel the onion, you know, get in there to the deep patterning. So then it's a gradual process, and as I do that, kind of each layer I peel back, certain seeds will ripen in that, you know, at that time, right? It's like, oh, I have to work with my anger, And I kind of get through that, and then a little while later, like, oh, I have to work with fear, I guess. Great, here I am. You know, you get to another layer, and you have the seeds that ripen there. Different thinkers, like, they're like, okay, that makes sense. So gradual makes sense, and the Buddha talked about it as a gradual path. But it's also clear that some folks, you know, they get exposed to some teaching, or they do a body of practice, and it's like the light just turns on, and they're suddenly in a very different state of wisdom and understanding than they were in before. And that also happens. And so then, you know, folks were like, well, how did that happen? That person didn't seem like they did gradual. It doesn't really seem like the Buddha did gradual, right? He was just like, he was totally afraid of old age, sickness, and death. He learned to meditate a little bit, but it didn't get him where he wanted to do. Then he starved himself, and that was kind of a mistake. And then, you know, he has like one idea about his childhood, and then boom, he's done forever, and he becomes the awakened one. Like, that seems a little sudden. And so then the idea came that, like, well, that's the ripening of karmic seeds of many, 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 many lifetimes of practice that then, you know, they burst into flower in this moment. And so then you can have these kind of, you know, breaking through experiences. And in practice, I know folks who had a dramatic breaking through early in their practice, and then it took them a long time to stabilize that and become truly wise. I know folks whose practice was like biking up an imperceptible slope, and it's just kind of a gentle amount of work for a very, very, very long time, and you don't feel like you've gotten anywhere except, you know, 20 years later you look back and you've got a great vista behind you, but it was long, slow, a long, slow climb with no dramatic chairlifts. I'm a little more like that. I didn't have any no drama in here very much, but a long, slow climb. And you know, and sometimes there's like there's sometimes it's you know how it is, like in chaotic systems, like sometimes there's a lot of one thing and then suddenly the phase shifts. And so they're both gradual and sudden are ways that systems change state. You know, when you heat up water toward boiling, it gradually goes toward boiling and then suddenly it turns to steam. So there's a gradual and a sudden in the you know, in the state shift. And so that's what it looks like mostly for practitioners as well. Yeah. Maybe that's a good place to pause. Let me finish the thought I was saying with Anicca, and then we'll see if there's any questions here, any further questions. But just the idea that the insight into impermanence, say, is a playing out or a manifestation of inner nonviolence, like to really recognize that the mental and emotional states that cling are a kind of subtle internal violence. Not intentional. You're not doing it on purpose. That's very ancient karma. Those are ancient seeds. But that seeing through it uproots them. And the thing about insight is that even if the path is gradual, there are insights that bump us to a new level of understanding. And you know, seeing impermanence is one of those, right? That once you see it in a profound way, it can't be unseen. And then for some time, I think you have to process that insight and come really figure out its full implications. Likewise, the insight into, you know, dukkha or dissatisfaction, suffering, that, you know, really seeing that, oh, this is what clinging does. You know, craving and clinging creates this kind of pain in the heart. And that the seeing of that and the uprooting of that as a kind of nonviolence for myself, like learning how to care for my own well-being such that I'm not indulging, you know, or I'm finding the root of those ancient, again, it's an ancient karma to crave, finding the root of the ancient karma of craving and clinging and uprooting it. And then, you know, one of the deepest of all is anatta. These are the three characteristics. So the felt sense of being, you know, an isolated individual self, right? And a solitary, really the felt sense of being alone, right? Disconnected from others, that I am an individual disconnected. That taproot goes, you know, to the core of our being, right? It goes to the core of like, who this being is here that has a name, to go back to speech, you know. What is this one that I call Sean, or that we call, that you call by your name? And is there actually a solitary, disconnected individual, you know, and a kind of eternal soul separate from others there? And the Buddha proposes that there isn't. And then again, that holding to the fixated sense of self, it does a kind of violence to the soul because it's just not true. And so then holding to that, again, mostly unconsciously, it prevents us from really seeing and understanding what's actually here, which is this extraordinary unfolding process that just doesn't need to be marked by distress and fear and you know, grief arising from clinging, that all of that can slough away, and what's left is a profoundly unharmed being. So So we'll let it rest there. Some reflections on inner and outer nonviolence, and a good question about the seeds of karma. We'll talk more about karma at some point. So thank you for your warm attention.